Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today by comedy writer Graham Linehan. And we'll be talking about his recently released debut book, Tough Crowd, which is a raw yet rip-roaringly funny memoir in which he charts his entry into writing through music journalism, his career, and finally his very public shunning by former showbiz friends because of his stance on, well, reality, really.
Yes.
So firstly, Graham, may I ask you, what did you want to achieve by writing Tough Crowd, and why did you think the time was right now?
Well, when the now in question is about the 3 years that it took to write the book, which had a number of false starts and was very difficult to write when I was still going through all the things that I was writing about. Every day seemed to bring some new attack on my reputation. And it was like kind of writing a book under heavy fire for a lot of the time. Like the very depressing flat I describe at the start of the book is where I began it. And, you know, it wasn't very good psychologically for me. I did move into a nicer flat in Norwich and then finally moved at the end of last year to a lovely spot in South London. And, you know, all the time I was trying to write the book. Basically, I just want to kind of expose the cowardice of the people in my old colleagues in the entertainment industry. They saw what was happening to me and they stood by and let it happen. They never stood up for me, defended me. They just watched as everything was taken from me, you know, including, I think, most disgracefully of all, my colleagues on the Father Ted musical, Neil Hannon and Arthur Matthews, who should have been the first to speak up for me. And to date have not, you know, Arthur said some very weak beer about me not being a bigot, but the problem with a position like the problem with a statement like that is it's like saying I'm not a wife beater. There's no proof that I'm a bigot out there. It's only a claim that's put forward by trans rights activists. And it's based on nothing except my desire to see single sex spaces maintained for lesbians not to be, you know, as you know, Jenny Watson, a young lesbian at the moment, cannot put on a lesbian event without being tormented by trans rights activists. And of course, the sterilization and mutilation of children, you know. So the idea that I'm a bigot for opposing these things, it's not enough for people to say, Graham's not a bigot. They have to say, yes, of course, women deserve fair sports. And of course, they deserve single sex spaces. And of course, children should be experimented on. But they don't for some reason. And all it would take would be a few people to make these very simple statements. And I wouldn't be so isolated and you know, essentially, basically tortured over the last few years with, you know, a kind of constant onslaught against my reputation and my ability to make a living. I still can hardly believe that Arthur and Neil watched that happen. You know, I am so shocked by it that, you know, friends could behave like that to another friend. And if it was reversed, there's no way I would have let them spin in the wind the way they've let me, you know. So the book was an attempt to put down my positions because they are so consistently misrepresented, and perhaps explain to these colleagues the extent of their betrayal, you know. And I have to say, right, but, you know, in the end, I did write one version that was very angry and upset. And Simon Edge, my editor, sent it back and said, you know, this is not the book you want to write, essentially. And he was right. I went back and I kind of Once I also had a weird structure because it was out of order. It wasn't in the right order. I was trying to be clever by jumping back and forwards through time. And when it went into the right order, I suddenly realized that it was a pretty good story, you know? So that was very therapeutic. And then that became the reason I was writing the book, because I suddenly started actually, like, I was able to come off my anti-anxiety medicine. I was able to relax a lot more. The more I told my own story, the better I felt. So, yeah, so that's where I am. Now it's its own reward, really.
Oh, no, thank you. That's good to hear. It's mad, isn't it, that holding for opinions that pretty much everybody holds should take moral grit, should take courage. But I sort of wonder where you got that from, in a way. So I know you open in the book by talking a bit about your dad and how he was religious, how he was a very sort of decent moral man with a strong faith. And I know that you're not religious, but I wondered if that strong sense of right and wrong and the duty you feel to tell the truth, no matter the consequences, was perhaps inspired by your dad.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's why I put him in there, you know. I kind of realized, you know, that all the, like, I may have leaned too much on the arguments. We argued a lot when I was a kid, but we didn't really continue that into adulthood. He was very proud as soon as he realized how good Father Ted was, and he kind of, you know, for someone who was as religious as he was, he used to go to church every day. He was very proud of me, and we reached a very nice position in our relationship. I think part of the reason that he remained proud was because one of the pieces of advice we got from an early commission, the person who commissioned the show, sorry, I've got WhatsApp on, I'll turn that off, from a person who commissioned the show, Seamus Cassidy, he said, you can make fun of anything, just don't make fun of basic tenets of belief. And that was, like, so useful, because, like, suddenly we realized what our parameters were. We could make fun of priests playing Ludo and stuff like that, but we rarely strayed into actually attacking the principles. In fact, one episode where we did talk about, you know, it all being a load of nonsense, we had one actor come in and he just used his time to complain about us and say we were disgraceful, you know. And I felt bad about that one, because I thought we'd kind of carefully managed not to step on anyone's toes by avoiding these basic tenets. But for the most part, you know, we even didn't really talk about the scandal in the church, you know. Ted just had one joke about where his maths is off, where he says something like, say there's a million priests in the world and that's only, I can't remember how it went, but it was something like, and 10% of them are pedophiles, that's still only 100,000, something like that. And so, you know, we the show kind of existed in this kind of silly world of its own. And it was very good natured. And I think Dad recognized that. And, you know, we got on great then for the rest of our lives, really, together, you know. So I made a lot of it just to show, I guess, the kind of heat that my personality was formed in, which was these arguments with my father when I was a teenager. But you know, yeah, I think I picked up from him a basic sense, definitely the idea of chivalry, not as a thing to do. I don't know. I know I believe chivalry has some sexist roots that are often complained about, but I genuinely do think that chivalry is like a code that can guide people in their everyday dealings, so that you lose some of the question about things. So, for instance, you see a woman with couple of heavy bags and she's having a problem, you help her. It's a very simple equation. If you see a man with a couple of heavy bags, you don't really make the same instant thing, because chivalry is the thing that makes that instant decision for you. And if that guides you through everything, I don't think that's a bad thing for men to do. I think it's, you know, on average, women are smaller and weaker physically. So there's certain things that as the stronger physically sex, we should do. It just seems clear to me. And one of the things I noticed happening was this kind of weird version of feminism that was growing up. And it wasn't an issue because I would just practice my chivalry privately. I wouldn't make a big deal out of this. I wouldn't even call it chivalry. But but I did notice that there was a brand of feminism coming up that was pretending that men and women were exactly the same in every way. And I felt that was, you know, I was troubled by it. It felt wrong. And it was only when the current kind of war on women started, I consider it a war on women, that I realized what it had led to. It had led to a place where everyone was able to pretend it was a level playing field between men and women. And so therefore anything done to women was kind of excusable or permissible, you know? So yeah, I think all that stuff came from just looking at the way my dad treated my mum. You know, he was just besotted with her, you know, and he did everything for her until, you know, he couldn't until the end. But I mean, even at the end, when he was just racked with pain from his back, he was still making cups of tea for her every 2 seconds, you know. Yeah, yeah, he was a lovely bloke, you know, and I miss him. But I wanted to make the point, though, that one of the most what you might call it therapeutic moments my dad and I had was when the marriage equality bill came up, and his instinct was to vote against it. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to him about it, and I persuaded him to vote for it, and I kind of, you know, didn't have to persuade too hard, because he realized it was the right thing to do. He knew that, like, morally you couldn't really stand in the way of allowing gay people to, you know, lead normal lives and not feel like they're outside of society. And so we had that conversation, and it was a very thorough, you know, chat for us to have. But of course, we never had the conversation about self-ID, because self-ID was sneaked into Ireland by the usual, you know, NGOs and various corrupt politicians and voices. And it just kind of got in without anyone talking about it. So I wanted to make the point that, you know, you can have a social movement that ends in such a great gain like marriage equality. That means one thing. It brings people closer together through talking about it, through settling differences. And then you have self-ID, which brooked no dissent, mm-hmm. led to no conversations between my dad and I, because we didn't even know it was happening. But I can guarantee you, we both would have voted against it.
it's interesting, isn't it, the way these sort of issues are collapsed quite deliberately. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I've felt sort of questioning trans ideology has really sort of made me think about wider issues, wider sort of default lefty opinions that I used to hold. And it's made me unpick them, and it's made me, I think, a much more of a critical thinker. So I guess, is there anything else, or any other sort of like lazy opinions that are held by those who think we're on the right side of history that actually you've begun to question since sort of taking an unpopular, if evidence-based view on why sex is real?
Yes, absolutely everything, I think I question everything now. And my great worry about where we're going as a society is that I don't think this questioning, there's a point at which questioning is useful, and it leads to, you know, careful thought and examining an issue from all sides and coming to a conclusion. But there's also a kind of hell on earth of unceasing questioning, because you just do not know whether you're being told the truth anymore. We see politicians now going on television and telling the most basic lie: trans women are women, trans men are men. It's like a complete inversion of the truth. So when that same politician comes on, and let's use a fictional example so that we don't get so that because people love to claim you're a denier of various things. Let's say a meteorite was heading towards Earth, and the only way we could stop it is, you know, I don't know, getting together in Trafalgar Square or something. Yeah. You know, it's going to be hard to corral people, you know, because we all live in this tiered reality now where some people believe a certain group of facts and others believe another. If you were a Guardian reader, you wouldn't know that the incident at the Wee Spa in, I think it was Los Angeles.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Ended with a sex offender being arrested, you know, or at least being hunted. I can't remember whether he was arrested or not. Yeah. And the Guardian did everything they could to cover up that story. They denied it. They claimed it was a hoax twice, and then in an interview with Judith Butler, they continued to claim it as a hoax, even though the interview with Judith Butler happened after the bloke was arrested.
Yes.
So they are like deliberately suppressing the truth. And I used to feel the same way. I used to have a lighter version of it when TV critics would talk about candle after. Because when you're there, like what you're talking to the audience and you see journalists claiming you're using candle after, you get this kind of weird, it's almost being lightheaded because you know it's not true. And yet there it is in print. And that's what's happening now about much more important things than whether or not there's an audience at a sitcom. And it's very destabilizing. It's upsetting that everyone is ignoring it, because to address it, you have to talk about these issues. And I really worry that it's going to lead to a wider doubt, where we simply cannot tell what's true anymore. And our desperation for answers and certainty, it might lead to, I don't know, it's already leading to a certain form of authoritarianism, and it might lead to an even worse one.
No, I can see people are sort of scratching around for some sort of voice of authority, and
There's no pilot anymore.
No.
It's like when Keir Starmer kneels down for Black Lives Matter. I mean, obviously Black Lives Matter, it's not a controversial statement, but the group was controversial, and the group has been found out to have been, you know, embezzling funds and all this sort of thing. There's also new data coming out about some of the incidents that led to Black Lives Matter. And Keir Starmer's kneeling down for it, you know, for this American movement that has nothing to do, like, you know, which was very fixated on things like reparations and the history of slavery in America. But because his spads are all completely influenced by America, the next thing he's kneeling down for it, you know? And I just find it, I find it very disturbing how, like, we always used to laugh, didn't we, at how you couldn't put a cigarette paper in between Labour and the Conservatives. Mm-hmm. It used to be kind of amusing because they're both neoliberals, neo-capitalists? Yeah.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, and that used to be kind of like, you know, just one of those things we shrugged about, and you know, you cast your vote with whoever you always cast your vote with. But I think now there's a kind of empty chair feeling. It's like, you know, we're going through some of the most disturbing and crucial art debates and moments, historical moments, and no one's at the wheel. No one's at the wheel, you know. We had Trump, where the feeling of no one being at the wheel was really exaggerated because he was so, you know, unsuited to that role. And I do believe he was unsuited. That's one of the things I still believe. I don't think he was a good temperament to have at the top. But yeah, what do you think?
Well, I'm supposed to be interviewing you, aren't I? So
I just saw a look down your face.
I guess no. I was just yes, I see the point. Also, do I think Ukraine would have kicked off if he was still there? Probably not.
That's interesting.
That's very true, isn't it? Yes. Well, you know, I mean, but that kind of leads to my point, you know, because then Biden comes in, and Biden is clearly too old to be in the job. He does. He obviously is like when Trump came in, Trump, it felt to me that the kind of bureaucracy to some extent took over, and the country just sort of ticked along with him, you know, issuing vague but then Biden came in, and the feeling of no one being at the wheel, I would never have believed it could happen, but it got worse, you know, with what he did to title nine.
Single sex sort of
and women's sports disappearing, and the Democrats are all for it. And, you know, when you see Biden interviewing Dylan Mulvaney, or Dylan Mulvaney interviewing Biden, you don't really, I would imagine he still doesn't know what was going on there.
Well, I think he does a lot of the time.
Exactly. So it's very disturbing, it's very frightening, and what you have in the kind of vacuum of leadership that creates is, like, the Democrat, I've seen Democrats in the States actually say out loud that the only reason they're supporting all this gender stuff is because it's not a right wing position.
Mm-hmm.
So they're literally doing it just because they feel that if they don't stand up for it, then they will be making it easier for Trump to win or something. So I think that it's frightening that people are kind of clinging to incoherence to stop a certain party from getting in. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I suppose, to return to the book a little bit. So with that sort of tribalism, I know that there's been, you know, predictably a kind of negative review in The Independent from some 12-year-old, and similarly in The Guardian, I think. But then also from our own side, from the sort of those who consider themselves gender critical, there's been a bit of sniping. So I was going to ask, do you think tribalism is a problem that also extends within sort of gender critical movement, and were you expecting friendly fire?
Yeah, I knew there would be, as soon as I heard Janet Turner of The Times had grabbed the review, I knew that wouldn't be good news. Because Turner, I think, is friends with Helen Lewis, who also decided. Basically, a couple of years ago, I got identical emails from a group of female journalists who don't cover this as much as they should, and all telling me to stop talking about it. I got basically the same email over and over again, and I politely said, "Oh well, you know, thanks for the advice, but I'll just keep." Yeah. Doing what I'm doing. Yeah. And these are people who write about the subject every couple of months when they can sneak a story past their editor. But the stories were coming in all the time, you know. And when Janet Turner calls me a monomaniac, the reason I am so single issue on this is because journalists like her are not covering these crucial stories. They're not covering things like WPATH linking to a page full of child pornography. They're not covering stories like Sally Hines writing a piece about how mothers should continue taking testosterone even if it causes birth defects in the baby. You know, these are how would you not be monomaniacal about trying to stop these crimes against humanity? You know, like that's what they are. The Eunuch Archive story by Genevieve Gluck is the most shocking story that's come out of this. And I don't think I've ever seen any of those journalists cover it.
I mean, it's really hard, isn't it? I remember when I sort of first started writing on this, and I remember trying to write about what was being taught in sex education as well, sort of 5-6 years ago. And I just don't think people believe me. I think they thought... And it's sort of, you know, I couldn't get editors interested. I think they just thought I was nuts.
That's part of it. It's so extreme, isn't it? And I remember I've had people criticize you as well in those early days when I thought everyone was together on this. I saw people badmouthing you as well, you know, because you wrote for Spiked and stuff like that. And it's like, how how is she supposed to, where is she supposed to get these stories published? Like Hadley Freeman was with The Guardian, you know, as long as she possibly could until she had to leave. And then she snipes at me, you know, all the time that she was at The Guardian, not writing about this subject. We were covering it. We have I know you know this, Joe. We have a piece called A Week in the War on Women, you know, and it catalogues every day. It has, like, you know, a new outrage. I would love if we didn't have to do it, but we're one of the very few who are. So if these journalists want to think I'm being too single issue about this, maybe they could do their jobs, you know, do their jobs. So a comedy writer doesn't have to do it for them.
And I suppose something else again, going back to the book, was that you said as a kid you'd been bullied. And I wondered if maybe it was perhaps looking at the bullying behaviour of trans activists that sort of sparked something in you and made you just sort of, you know, want to stand up to them.
Yeah, well, you know, definitely. And I didn't linger too much on the bullying in the book because I think it's such a cliche for comedy writers to talk about being bullied. It's such a, you know, I made people laugh to stop being hit, all that stuff. That's the story of every second comedy writer or comedy performer. But yeah, it was a major part of my childhood was being bullied. And what was so disturbing about this particular fight as well was that I noticed exactly the same dynamics playing out. You know, if you're being bullied, then you're also shunned. You know what I mean? Because people do not want to get whatever is attracting the bullies to you on them, you know? And the same thing started happening, you know, like friends started distancing themselves. Like there was one group, for instance, Cooked and Bombed, who I write about in the book, a website of Chris Morris fans. And there's one guy in it who has been stalking me since 2007, since the IT Crowd came out. An Australian, he's a troll living in Australia. My brother-in-law shared a tweet of his at a time when I was still trying to keep my family together. So it was not just being bullied by these kind of outside groups. It was like people within my circle starting to join in with it. So it was pretty rough, you know, it kind of still is. But, you know, I just had to kind of keep my head down and trust that eventually people would see and do the right thing. But, you know, as I often say, I shouldn't have had to write a book to get people to see what was being done to me. You know, it was interesting. This, you know, the people who kind of who attacked me and who blanked me and called me names and, you know, did things like what my brother-in-law did to me, they never had the guts to tell me exactly where my analysis was wrong in all this. Mm-hmm. Not a single person ever said, well, I disagree with you because X, Y. They just took pot shots at me publicly, you know? And it's because they don't dare say their opinions out loud because they know they'll be arguing for an end to female sports, an end to female spaces, the continuation of children being medicalized unnecessarily. They can't vocalize all that stuff because they deep down they know it's wrong. And yet they still stood on the other side and just watched as all this was being done to me. So yeah, it's been a little traumatic going back to that feeling of being bullied at school. But you know, I'm older now, I could deal with it better, and I you know, I have so many great friends within this movement now who've been through similar. So yeah, it's tough, but I'm getting through it.
So what have you got planned next?
Well, I don't know. I've got a few. I really like writing a book. It's kind of good to write a book because then you kind of know, oh, I can write a book, and once you find that out about yourself, you think, well, maybe I could do it again. So that's kind of exciting to me. So yeah, I might just write another book. I might just get straight on it, you know.
Fiction, something kind of comedy fiction, or
Well, funny enough, I think the best way for me to get jokes in is just to write about what's happening, because like sometimes my experience is like the ink hadn't dried on the book when I got banned from the Edinburgh Fringe, and I was ambushed by Piers Morgan's show. Those two things happened within 2 days of one another, and ever since then it has not stopped. Like the you know, Pink News publishing that we'd only sold 300 books or something like this.
I gather it's 10,000 in the first run.
Yeah, we've 10,000 are out there. I think we've sold about, and we've definitely sold at least 4,000 of them, because I signed 3,700, you know. So it just keeps happening, and what I know about this the position that I'm in is that it won't stop happening. It'll keep coming. I will be attacked and attacked and attacked and lied about and misrepresented and ambushed and tricked, and all these sorts of things will happen. And I just thought, well, maybe I'll write about that. So that's kind of my thinking at the moment, just to write about the insanity of what happened as soon as I stopped writing Tough Crowd.
I think we're nearly running out of time. So, okay. But thank you so much for talking to me and for sharing that. And I hope you sort of carry on, and good luck with the upcoming book. So yeah.
Thank you so much, Jo. Lovely to talk to you.
No worries.